You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts, the Heroes Podcast Network's dedicated Star Trek podcast. I am your host, Derek. My co-host and cohort, Greg, is still on his away mission, so we are continuing our reviews of the Star Trek TNG era films. Last week, we reviewed Star Trek Generations, and this week we move on to First Contact. I have my same guests from last week, returning guests Ray.
Hello.
And Zach.
Hey.
And if we sound a little different, it's because we're recording a little bit differently this week, so hope that sounds good for you guys. So before we begin our review, we always talk a little bit of news, and this past weekend was New York Comic Con, where basically the entire Discovery cast was there to have a cool panel. Lots of information came out. Mm-hmm. So first off, the show comes back January 17th. We have an official date. It's a Thursday. So it's moved from Sunday to Thursday. Feels more prime time.
Yeah. It's a step in the right direction.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like it's about the same. Sunday is where where most networks put their best shows, you know, Walking Dead Sunday evening on AMC. And
the question that I want to know is, I mean, how much does the air date even matter anymore as far as shows are concerned? Because so many people watch it streaming. A lot of people, even like more hardcore fans, like they may not watch it like the minute it airs. They may watch it the next evening after work or whatever the case may be.
Well, I mean, the initial night numbers do matter, right?
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Because it has to do with what it's going up against, you know, what other shows are coming out. Since it is a weekly thing, it's not like when Netflix drops, like, all of Daredevil Season 3, right? This is a weekly thing. So it still matters. I wonder if maybe Thursday night has less competition in the winter.
Maybe. You know?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But lots of cool stuff. We had a new trailer for Season 2. It showed us...
We did.
Bearded Spock.
He's a little cutie.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You think so?
I started following his Twitter today. He's very excited about the new show. All he's doing is, you know, promoting it and talking about how he's very lucky to be a part of it. And
yeah.
If the character's bad, the character's bad. But it's obviously not going to be his fault because he seems to be hella on board.
I love his optimism. I am nervous, though, especially, I mean, I have higher hopes for the Star Trek fan base, but nervous in the sense that toxic fandom has been a problem in recent years, and I'm worried that if people don't receive his Spock well, and there's big shoes to fill there, but I'm worried that if they don't receive it well, that it's going to cause problems, and I don't want to see his optimism turned into cynicism after taking on this big role.
Yeah, so of course the person we're talking about, his name is Ethan Peck, and people are already getting on the character for the brief moments that we see him.
What's the point? I don't know. Sporting a beard?
Like, yeah, I mean, his hair is very similar to Spock's hair at the beginning of the motion picture.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, kind of the long, shaggy, was a bowl cut, but isn't anymore kind of thing.
Sure.
And then, yeah, he has the full beard, which we've never seen Spock have a full beard.
No.
Because, you know, he was still grooming in Mirror, Mirror. He just kept the goatee.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think it's weird to slam a character's first look when you haven't had any acting yet, right? Like, the character's obviously, Spock's been missing somewhere for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm. He's asleep. He grew some facial hair in his dormancy.
I mean, look, it doesn't look anywhere near as ridiculous as that one alternate timeline Riker, where the Borg have taken over and he like actually has the comically large beard.
Yeah.
You know, so like that's happened on Star Trek. So I think he looks fine. I mean, I gotta wait and see what the character is like.
That's important. I'm withholding judgment for that point, but I like his optimism. I will say, too, not to get ahead of ourselves, we're obviously going to be talking about First Contact more later, but rewatching First Contact today in preparation for this, I realized Ethan Peck looks a lot like that first Vulcan that steps off the ship at the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah?
I didn't really notice that,
but that's interesting.
Yeah, I only noticed it because it was just today after I just watched the trailer and it was fresh in my mind. Because Ethan Peck... handsome, objectively handsome dude, but he does have some very unique features that look very Vulcan, and I can see from a visual standpoint why they cast him.
Yeah, if you compare him to the other, like, the child Spock characters,
yeah,
the casting is spot on. He may not look as much like Leonard Nimoy, but he looks just like all of the kid Spocks.
Yes, definitely.
Even the animated series one, I saw a comparison of that, and it's pretty funny.
Cute.
Which is fine. I like the animated series.
Same.
So other design type things. We saw a Klingon D7 battlecruiser.
Mm-hmm.
The Klingons all have hair.
They all have hair.
Yeah.
Because it's no longer a time of war.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're kind of, I don't know, retcon's a little strong, but they're kind of expanding on the episode Rightful Heir from TNG and saying that, well, it's not a time of war, so they didn't shave their heads. There's been some arguments on Twitter about how, well, the war hadn't started yet when we were introduced to these Klingons at the beginning of Discovery.
We were also introduced to the rebel ones, the ones that were outcasts. So maybe they were at war.
Right, maybe they were embodying war as a rebellion.
Yeah, they wanted to start a war.
Yeah.
Right? So they were already prepared.
Yeah.
Okay? They didn't want to be the Klingons who are like, all right, war started, let's go shave.
Yeah.
They were prepared and ready to go.
These are proactive Klingons. They are shaved and prepared for war.
I mean, they look great. I think they look great.
I think it's just very similar to why they wanted to explain away the Romulans' tattoos in the 09 film. Like, they just came up with an in-universe way why this group of people had this body decision and went with it. And I think it's fine.
We also got to meet number one. Rebecca Romijn.
Didn't recognize her
number one.
The dark hair.
Yeah. Still don't have a name.
There's a side-by-side floating around Twitter of Majel. Mm-hmm. Majel's number one, and then Rebecca's. And man, like, it's some spot-on casting.
Yeah.
Rebecca
really Romijn Lettuce really pulls it off.
One cool thing that somebody noted is that, you know, Pike's going to be captain of the Discovery for at least somewhat of a time. And that means that number one will be captain number one.
Yeah.
I like it. How would you guys feel if they made it very on the nose and just named her Majel?
I don't know.
I mean, part of me thinks
that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing this out there as like a what if.
It's a really nice tribute.
I wouldn't mind. I'm a fan of Majel Barrett in all of her roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
both,
I mean, that's
a computer and Lwaxana.
It would be a nice way for the character, for her name to live on in the character, you know, would be cool. I mean, I'm fine with that.
It was the very first character that Majel played out of her four.
Did she have a name?
No.
Okay.
Not in canon.
Right. Yeah. Nurse Chapel was her first named character.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Number one was just number one, you know, she was never given a name, so.
So just a fun what if. I doubt they're going to do that. It'll probably be something completely different. But.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're
probably
right.
It'd be nice
to
some sort of, like, subtle nod.
Mm-hmm. Like, maybe your last name's Barrett. Who knows?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that would be cool. I'd be totally for that. Yeah, I'm good with it. All right, so any other news? Let's see. In the Picard show, Alex Kurtzman said that they actually view this as an ongoing series instead of a limited one-shot.
Yeah, which makes me happy.
Which is surprising.
That's what I wanted to hear.
It's just really surprising to me because the show, I mean, I suppose if they really burned through it and did it very quickly, maybe they could hit next fall.
Yeah.
But that would be really fast.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know. It depends on how many episodes. If they only ordered 6 to start out with for this new series, which is becoming more and more popular, then it's possible to get those shot and edited and ready to go for the fall. But anything more than that, and there's going to be a delay like we saw with Discovery.
Yeah. Yeah. So either way, multiple seasons should be cool.
Yeah. A lot to explore. I mean, ever since the 09 films came out, I've been wanting more of the Prime universe post Nemesis, and so this is really exciting.
Will Wheaton wants to return.
I saw that.
That would be so cool.
Yeah,
right.
I'm all on board for that.
I mean, not a surprising thing. You know, I'm sure that most of the TNG actors probably want to be involved.
Yeah.
But I think Will Wheaton is a really good choice because his character is on the younger side.
Yeah.
Right. And so we don't know what happened really when he left to be with the Traveler. We see him, you know, at the wedding in Nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really it. We don't, I mean, he's in a Starfleet uniform.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say maybe he returned
back,
and came back to Starfleet. So maybe he's a captain.
Yeah.
You know, Captain Crusher, you know, by this point.
I'm just imagining a heartwarming moment between him and Picard where Wesley's, like, dispensing some sort of wisdom to Picard, and he lovingly and calmly says, "Shut up, Wesley." With a different tone and delivery.
See, I was hoping that it was going to be, like, during a big hug or something. Kind of like the Renee Zellweger, you had man, hello. Yes. It says, "Shut up, Wesley."
Well, Will Wheaton hates that, so they might not do it because it bothers him a great deal.
Right.
The fans ruined it.
The fans ruined
it. Or I should say overkill. The anti-fans. Like, yeah. They really did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we can't have anything nice, right?
Yeah. Welcome to America, 2018.
Anytime there's a catchphrase, especially in the 80s and 90s, it got overused. Jaleel White hates "Did I Do That?" And, you know, why am I forgetting his name? He passed away. He had a form of dwarfism. He was on Different Strokes. What you talking about?
Gary Coleman?
Yeah. That got overused to the point where he was very upset. So,
no one wants to be known for one thing.
For their catchphrase. Because these characters had growth. They had arcs. They changed. You know, especially Wesley went through a lot as a character. Yeah. And to see him come back would be pretty cool because, you know, he has a real opportunity to be a mainstay in that timeline. Whereas a lot of the rest of the cast, I mean, 20 years after Nemesis, Riker's probably an admiral because,
I want Admiral Riker on that show. I love Jonathan Frakes so much.
Geordi, I guess, could be a captain, but he could have moved up to an admiral after 20 years, too.
What about Brent Spiner? Are they going to bring on an aged B4?
I don't think that would make any sense.
I don't think so either. But
I really don't.
You know, it makes me sad because Data.
They could have maybe flashbacks or video.
They could de-age him. Obviously, we're doing that now.
That's the key, right? So that no TV shows haven't really done the de-aging thing yet.
They haven't had to,
right? And so this would be an opportunity to do that. But maybe depending on how they do the show, they could keep costs down because they don't need a lot of special effects if it's a more character-driven show, right? Because, you know, this is 20 years later, Picard, he's probably not a member of Starfleet anymore. Yeah. And so you're not necessarily going to have these big ship battles and things like that. So maybe you spend some extra money and you de-age Brent Spiner and, you know, bring Data back. I mean, I'm one of those people who thinks we don't need Data to come back, as I know he has in Beta Canon and Star Trek Online's timeline and in the comic books. You know, he's come back. But I just think that kind of belittles what happens to him in Nemesis.
Agreed.
Yeah, you know? That's fair.
Will Wheaton wants to come back. That would be cool. I'd love to see Jonathan Frakes, LeVar Burton, and even Roxanne Dawson do some directing on Picard. Cool. I think would be really cool
I guess he could bring anyone back from DS9 and Voyager.
Like, absolutely.
All of them too.
Robert Duncan McNeil is a big director as well. Mm-hmm. I would like to see Star Trek veterans who are directors direct some of this.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think would be really cool to see, especially since, you know, it's Kirsten Byers' show and she's a Star Trek author. Like that's her thing, is writing Voyager books. And
if they bring Wheaton back, then I'd also want to see little Sisko and Nog come back too.
Same.
Very yeah, so. I mean,
that's... It doesn't have to be like for the entire show, maybe an episode or something. Like,
well, if this is an ongoing thing, there's no reason why season 2, season 3, there can't be like a return of Sisko subplot. Like,
Jake would be a hard character to tie in simply because he's not a member of Starfleet.
Yeah, I'm okay with that though.
Right? I mean, Nog is.
If Picard's not a part of Starfleet, I mean.
Yeah, but he's
they meet up on Ryza. I don't know, dude.
Jake's like a reporter though. Like, I don't know that. And he and Sisko.
Maybe Jake gets together and wants to bury the hatchet between Picard and Sisko. I don't know. I think it's just fan service at this point. We're just talking about the things we want to see.
Well, so that's why I'm talking more directors, like because they directed Star Trek before.
Yeah,
they've got. I think they
would be good fits. They know the characters. They know Patrick Stewart, especially in Jonathan's and LeVar's cases.
Yeah.
And let's face it, Jonathan's Star Trek movies that he directed are pretty amazing, which is why they wanted him to direct Beyond before Justin Lin was attached to the movie.
That's why he's on Discovery.
He's doing Discovery. He's doing the Orville. There's a reason why he keeps being attached to those types of projects.
And truth be told, I never want a story to suffer for fan service. So, you know, story first, fan service is, you know, not even second.
Yeah.
Any fan service that's in there is fine, but I'm still a fan, so.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. All right. So any other news that I missed? Did I miss anything?
No.
That's the big stuff.
Okay. All right, well then we are going to move on to our review of Star Trek First Contact after we take a short break.
Hey there, I'm Batman, and I wanted to tell you about my friends at the Screen Heroes Podcast. They deliver sweet justice in the form of discussing movies, television, and me. They love my movies, every single one of them. Yes, even that one. Sometimes they even have me on as a guest, which is thrilling. You can find them at twitch.tv/heroespodcasts, live on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Gotham time. If you can't tune in live, the new shows go up on places like Spreaker, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Gotham Radio, Themyscira Live, and Blog Talk Radio. Now, back to your regularly scheduled Batcast.
All right, and we are back, ready to talk Star Trek First Contact. So the first of kind of the mainstream Star Trek films, the first one that even non-Trekkies went to go see, it's one of my favorites, if not my favorite Star Trek movie out of all of them.
I think objectively it is just the best movie. If you're going to watch one Star Trek film, that should be the one to do it, because you get a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I think it's a wide range. It introduces these characters very quickly. Mm-hmm. It introduces the Borg very quickly. It's got an interesting premise. You learn a lot of history of the Federation, of Picard, what he's mm-hmm. been through. Special effects are really solid. It was nominated for a bunch of awards.
It manages to be a quality action film while still embodying the optimism and hope that is Trek.
Mm-hmm. And TV shows are able to handle ensemble casts a lot better than movies are, but this one did a really great job.
Yeah.
Splitting them up, keeping everybody's story very interesting. Nobody was forgotten.
So yeah, Jonathan Frakes is just really good at getting the best performance out of those actors. So we start with Picard's Inception nightmare dream sequence. Mm-hmm. What did you guys think of that as like an opening for the movie?
Cinematic. It draws you in. I mean, like any good action horror film, you've got to have like that big punch at the beginning to draw audiences in. When did this come out? 1997?
96.
96, yeah.
Yeah.
So like we're past the days of cinematic slow burn. You got to have that big first real punch, and that delivered. It was, you know, shocking. It was maybe a little bit more surprising at that point than it would be now. But yeah, I mean, it was a good opener.
It added context clues too, because mm-hmm. I still have yet to see the episodes where he is assimilated. So that was nice that it was backstory without a ton of exposition. And it wasn't excessive, it wasn't over the top, it didn't bore me. I got what I needed to get out of it and could understand without asking a ton of questions.
Yeah, smartly done.
Fair enough. I like how, so it's two levels of the dream, right? And in the first one, he's wearing his TNG era uniform. Mm-hmm. And in the second one, he's wearing the new era uniform that he'll be wearing for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of an interesting little touch that I'm sure was on purpose.
Yeah. I didn't think he refilmed anything from the first scene. It looked like it was straight out of the TV show.
No, that was refilmed. That was new.
Really? Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah, you don't get to see any of that stuff, because the original Borg look really different.
Yeah,
that's fair.
And you don't really get to see him get assimilated. You see him get abducted, mm-hmm. and then he's Locutus.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a bit of a jump there. And so this, you know, the inside of the Borg cube, I guess, looks almost the same. I mean, obviously, it's higher quality in the movie, but yeah. That didn't change a whole lot. But yeah, that was all new footage.
Okay, that's fair.
But
and then there's the false start, the third phase of the dream, where it's like it embodies his fear that he is going to become the Borg again, where he wakes up but doesn't really wake up, and then it pops out of his face.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's a cool moment.
It is, yeah. It's like, oh, good, we're out of that dream. No, you're not.
No, you're not.
It's little jump scare.
Inception, yep. 10 years before Inception.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a cool moment. And I like that, you know, so, you know, he's talking to the Admiral and he's like, yes, I know, the Borg. Like, he already understands exactly what's going on, which I thought was really cool.
It gives a depth to his character as well. It shows that he has some PTSD lingering yeah. from his abduction. And, you know, we talk about how trauma affects you on just a daily basis as a society. Mm-hmm. So it's great that they were touching on that back then.
Yeah, especially for Trek. And I don't remember what Roddenberry's thoughts were on this film. I can't imagine that he loved some of these aspects of
Kirk's narrative. I don't think he wasn't still alive.
Oh, he wasn't still alive, was he? That's right. Yeah, he passed.
He definitely was not alive during First Contact. So he would not have had any ideas about any opinions.
But I can't imagine that he would have loved it because of Picard and his anger, his PTSD, because that was very much against what he wanted to see for the Federation in season one.
But okay, so Roddenberry died in 91.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So TNG was still on the air. We didn't have the Generations movie yet. But we already had the assimilation. So the Borg existed, and you already had the episode Family, where Picard goes home and deals with some of the PTSD with his brother. Mm-hmm. So there is some of that anger and things like that, but I think Gene would have been okay with that simply because it's an external force.
Sure, it's not within the Federation.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was the big key. That's why,
it's a valid point. You know,
the TNG crew is so sterile with each other, right? Because mm-hmm. we're supposed to be one big happy family. Right. Everything's an external conflict, which DS9 and Voyager and Enterprise, of course, were able to separate from, because by then Gene was no longer part of the picture.
Yeah. But that was interesting to see how a utopian society, just the juxtaposition of this utopian society and something as traumatic as PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you get the beautiful shot of the brand new Enterprise E. It's our first look at a new Enterprise I guess if you count the Enterprise A, that is actually shown later. And then we had the B, I guess, in Generations. You get to see the B in Generations. That's the new one. But yet another new ship. What do you guys think of the E as a, you know, sequel to the D?
I'm not a vehicle person. I care about what occurs on the inside. So, like, I told you while we were watching it, you're going to have to just put them all up against each other and let me see them, because they look the exact same to me. This one looks, of course, more cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as a newer Trek fan, I don't know if that's because of the design of the ship or because of the filming. So
I love the E. It is one of my favorite ships in all of Trek. It's one I don't actually own a model of personally, but I would like to. I, especially as a big DS9 fan, which we'll touch on, you know, more as we continue to discuss these movies and the influence of some of the other things happening in Trek on these movies. But the Enterprise E seems to have a bit of a Cardassian influence in its design, which is very telling for that point in Federation history, which I find cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the E is really nice. So it's not my favorite. Is that your favorite Enterprise?
No, not my favorite.
Which is your favorite Enterprise?
Ooh, God.
Ray, do you have a... Yeah, I guess you don't really have a favorite then, because it's not really your thing.
The silver one?
The silver one?
Yeah, aren't they like painted silver or something? Like, I don't know.
So, Zach?
It would be in between the original Enterprise and the D. Would probably be tied for first, and the E would be a close second.
So when you say the original, do you mean from the TV show or the refit in the movies?
The original, original.
The original, original.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, cheesy, kind of bad, but it has that special place in my heart. And then the D, of course, as being the Enterprise from TNG, like, that's very nostalgic for me. So those two are probably tied for first, with the E being kind of a close second place.
My favorite is actually the Dreadnought Galaxy Class, the D refit in All Good Things.
Yeah.
That's actually my favorite.
That one had the quad.
Three.
Three. Yeah.
Yeah, the quad was the Stargazer.
Oh,
Stargazer had four. Yeah. But yeah, the triple nacelles and the phase cannon or whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Could go warp 13, which was a thing.
Because apparently we forgot that going warp was causing, like, galactic tears in a global warming sense. We're just totally avoiding
it. It's only when you go warp 10. When you go above warp 10, everything's fine.
Oh,
it's gotta get is. You gotta get over
warp
the hump.
Warp
10's
just that, like, dangerous sweet spot. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, just, like, overriding that episode.
So we're introduced to the new Enterprise, and then almost immediately we're introduced to Geordi's new eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Those are cool.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think they spent a little too much time, like, focusing in on them
mm-hmm.
and watching them do their thing. Like, I thought once was enough. I didn't think he had to keep doing it, but it was pretty great. I'm really happy for him. A little upset they didn't offer it to him sooner.
Yeah, I mean, he basically had to demand it.
Yeah.
After generations, he's like, I'm not doing this with a visor again.
Right.
You know, and you got to have Geordi. You can't do it without Geordi. So I love those cybernetic eyes. It's super cool. I wonder, you know, what kind of vision he has compared to the visor, because the visor, you know, was really helpful in a few situations.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, his new eyes are very helpful in this one, because he can zoom and he can see like he
zoom in on cock and peeing.
Taking a leak.
Oh, leak.
That's funny. But yeah, his eyes are super cool.
Mm-hmm.
What else? We have the new uniforms, which if you watched Deep Space Nine, you got to see those as well, because they were introduced in Deep Space Nine after the movie.
Sure. Yeah.
I love these uniforms.
Yeah, they're my favorites.
They're really good.
They are.
How do you feel, though, about Picard's, like, vest alternative version that nobody else has?
It's a little dated. I don't think it ages well.
No?
It was to obviously make him look more of an action hero. It was a throwback to Kirk's, like, open chest kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, did it achieve that? We'll never know.
Why didn't we get bare-chested Picard is really the question.
I've been asking that my entire life. Why have I not seen that man naked yet?
I'm sure you can knock on his door.
There are very few nudes I want to see. Is this one?
Is this one of your fan goals for the new Picard show? Full frontal, Patrick Stewart.
It's going to happen. Klingon boobs. I don't see why.
It's true.
We can't see.
We assume Patrick Stewart's packing. You know.
They're shirtless Picard. That is a thing that has happened.
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
On Rising.
But, you know, CBS wasn't into the full frontal nudity Picard.
Not yet.
Surprisingly.
Yeah. CBS All Access can do what they want.
That's true, they can. All right, so the Enterprise, of course, has to stay out of things because Picard will introduce an unstable element to the Borg altercation.
I totally understand. You don't know. Nobody else but Picard knows what they're going through. However, that right there is a huge variable.
So let me throw this out there. Think of it not as a movie anymore, but as in-universe, how this would be handled.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, Riker's been the first officer on the Enterprise for 7-8 years. He's been offered at least 2 commands and even took command of the Enterprise for a time while Picard was assimilated.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Enterprise, which Geordi notes is the most sophisticated ship in the fleet.
Yeah.
You bench Picard and you give Riker command of the Enterprise for this engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That would have worked. That was a much better way to handle this.
Then, of course, Riker gives command over to Picard because that's how the story would go. But, right, like, that's what you do. Why would you leave your firehouse ship out of the fight at Earth against your number one enemy?
The wonderful line that Data says, to hell with our orders. Like, that's why you do it. So Data can just be the rebellious teenager.
That one line is worth it all.
Yeah, Data grows a lot between generations and First Contact. He really gets the emotion ship under control.
Yeah.
It is a great line, though. You know, to hell with our orders is a great line. He gets another good one in Insurrection that we'll talk about next week.
I mean, he gets a really good moment in each film. Like, I really liked in Generations when they got the Klingon ship, and he's just like, yes!
I love that.
It's so ridiculous, but it's perfect.
He gets a few good moments in this movie.
He does. But it is a good moment because it's very telling about the crew of the Enterprise, because the show TNG gets a lot of knocks for being very sterile and everybody's so perfect and, you know, proper and everything. But the reality is that they break orders a lot to do the right thing.
I never got that. Like, I just kept thinking, wow, they're the prettiest cast. How are they not boning each other? Like, everybody should just be like, let's have a commune and we'll just share custody.
I mean, Riker and Troi kind of had a free-for-all open relationship that was never openly discussed.
Well, according to, I mean, again, we'll talk about it next week in Insurrection, but apparently they haven't done anything in many years because of the beard situation.
Really?
So
I don't know if I knew that.
In Insurrection, when they kiss, he kisses her, and she laughs and says, yuck, and she goes, I've never kissed you with a beard before, and he goes, I kiss you, and you say yuck, and she closes the door in his face. It's one of my favorite moments.
I forgot about that, you're right.
And so that means that they would not have made out since, like, the first season. season of the show.
But I'm trying to, I thought I remember them kissing at least at one point post season one, but maybe not.
Continuity problem?
I don't know. Like,
we're going to have to binge the series just to find out.
Watch all seven seasons before next week. I don't
we're have not anything even else past like the first 15 minutes of the film, guys.
All right. Let's move moving along. So, okay. Of course, obviously, the Enterprise decides to go because they're going to do the right thing. So they cut to the battle, which is a really cool battle. Because previously, you know, they had a TV show budget in 1989, I think, is when The Best of Both Worlds was filmed. So, you know, lower budgets, earlier technology, TV show, you know, camera technology. And, you know, here you've got ship models that you've never seen before, like the Akira class. The Defiant swoops in there, which if you're a DS9 fan is super cool.
And Adam Scott.
Adam Scott shows up.
I love DS9, I love Adam Scott, I love Worf. It's just a happy moment.
It's the Enterprise. I'm sure he loved being able to say that line. Everybody's been in Star Trek.
Catalina wine mixer.
So it's a cool scene though, right? Like, it's really cinematic. There's lots of ships moving around, lots of explosions and stuff happening, and the Enterprise just swoops in and it's freaking massive compared to the other ships around it. It really dwarfs, especially the Defiant.
Little.
What'd you guys think of that scene though,
of the battle?
Just the whole action sequence.
It's very well done, very cinematic.
I mean, it looked pretty grim, right? Like, it's supposed to look like they're just gonna get destroyed. So the fact that Picard comes in and saves everything in a matter of seconds makes me just so mad that he was put in a timeout the entire time.
Target these points. These don't appear to be critical.
So many lives.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so there's that, but then there's also the hesitation that he has for a minute. Like, so he, you know, he's the fleet's standing by and they're ready and everything, and they're just looking at the screen. You're just watching, and the ship explodes during this time frame. And then he says his dramatic fire. And I know that's to build suspense for the movie, but like, at least a few hundred people die during that time gap. But yeah, it's amazing, right? Because he comes in, he picks a spot on the Borg cube that Data says is not important at all, right? It's not a vital system, and it blows the whole thing up. It does help that the Enterprise E has new torpedoes, as quantum torpedoes, which I don't think the Defiant had yet.
At what point do the Borg transport over? Because, like, is it from the cube or is it from that rescue ship? That
the sphere.
It's from the sphere.
It's definitely from the sphere. Because basically the way it's kind of framed, and it's a really quick kind of throwaway thing, is that once they go through the time vortex, their shields are down. And that's when the transport happens. Because during the battle, their shields are up. And I don't know, it's a little silly because being able to beam through shields is something that happens. Like, the Borg have been able to do that on the TV show anyway. So I'm not really sure why that's a particularly relevant thing. Maybe that was for more of like the general masses who are watching it. But yeah, the sphere is interesting.
Is it the first time we saw a sphere? I don't remember.
I think it's the first time we see anything that's not a cube. You know?
They just love shapes.
They do. Well, it's all geometry. It is. It's all because there's like the little diamond thing. That's the Queen's ship is a little diamond. And there's, you know, the tactical cube, and there's different stuff, but no, the movie gets a couple of knocks from people who kind of look a little deep into the plot here, and the question's like, well, why not send more than one cube? Right? Like, they only ever send one, and unfortunately Voyager shatters any answer you could possibly come up with, because like, there's thousands of cubes in the Delta Quadrant, so they could have sent, like, I don't know, three. But they just send the one. So sphere is only supposed to hold like a dozen or so drones. It's a pretty small complement. And it doesn't even sound like they beamed all of them over. You know, maybe they only beamed over like the Queen and like two drones or something.
But with, you know, with Borg, like, you don't have to have a full, you know, full array. You can go in with one or two and get the job done.
Now, I mean, I saw this first when I was a kid, so I don't really remember, but how, do you, either of you, when you watched it and you, you know, you heard the throwaway line about like, you know, the environmental controls being off and the guy goes up in the Jeffries tubes and gets like attacked or whatever, did you think immediately that, well, that's obviously the Borg, or did you think something else was going on?
I mean, when I first saw this, I hadn't seen all of Next Gen at that point because I was a little bit older. But I mean, I knew it was First Contact and it was like the Borg movie. So, I mean, it wasn't like the trailers and like the information I had received ahead of time had exactly masked the fact for me that like whatever the ominous threat was going to be, that it was Borg.
Now, when Geordi just says the throwaway line, it's getting a little warm in here. I completely forgot why that even mattered. Right. I was just like, oh, it's, you know, 5 degrees short of people taking off their tops. Whatever.
Like, LeVar just wanted to roll up his sleeves right. and an excuse.
Exactly. But no, when Porter got captured, it's very obvious that it's the Borg. Now, the only way that I would think it was something else, I don't know. You told me ahead of time that it was the Borg movie, so I assumed it was the Borg that nabbed him. But Trek is kind of notorious of bringing in multiple villains in one film, so they could have had a bait and switch, and it would have been a completely different film, but I would have been none the wiser ahead of time. I just assumed that they were sticking with one villain throughout the whole thing.
That's fair. So, all right, so now we end up on Earth in 2063 in Montana. So, they go down, they check the missile, all that stuff, and we're introduced to Alfre Woodard.
Yeah, Lily. Yeah.
Lily, she's awesome.
Mm-hmm. She is.
She's really fun. It's almost a shame she doesn't go back with them.
I know. Yeah.
I wanted her and Picard to kiss so much. Right. Like, just make out already. You two are wonderful.
Watch your caboose, dicks. No, she's really cool. The data dropping down from the higher level doesn't age particularly well, but because most of the special effects in the movie do age pretty well because it's mostly practical effects.
Yeah, the Borg look great.
Right, the Borg look good. The ship looks good, but that scene.
A few moments. It's just
little things.
I forgive few moments. If it's the entire film, then I get really annoyed because why am I watching this if half of it or most of it is unwatchable? But small things like that are completely, you know, it's fine to overlook. Fair suspension enough. Of disbelief.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan of Doctor Who, including the classic stuff, so I'm you know, well-versed in overlooking really bad effects.
That's fair.
Speaking of which, are the Borg or are they not Cybermen?
I mean, There was a comic series where like the two of them faced off.
That's cool.
A number of years ago, and that was pretty cool. But, yeah, I mean they're basically interchangeable.
They have the same goal. The Borg are just slightly more violent, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and they're more capable. They're deadlier. It's easier to escape a Cyberman than a Borg.
A little bit slower moving, but they're more. The Cybermen are a little bit classier. They've got that whole British thing going for them. A little more refined, very shiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the Borg also come in like huge numbers all the time.
Yeah,
right.
The Cybermen are only like 5 or 10, unless it's a huge area. Yeah.
And that's the thing, like the Borg are always in the thousands, in the millions, you know. It's only a handful of drones when like they weren't trying to find you. Right.
Right.
You know, I'm convinced that old Doctor Who was very, very influenced by TOS. Mm-hmm. At least Doctor Two and Doctor Three. And then, you know, about the same time, Roddenberry was very influenced by like 4 and 5. So
yeah.
I suppose. Yeah. I don't really watch Doctor Who, so it's hard for me to have any perspective on that.
They are very, very similar shows.
Yeah.
They are as a fan, those are like probably my top two fandoms. Like Trek and Doctor Who are two things that I will, you know, sort of blindly follow into any new endeavor.
Fair enough. Now, the Borg, you know, they started off originally, they were supposed to be insect-like creatures, like beehives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was not practical financially to build that type of alien on the show.
Not until Enterprise.
You know,
with,
right.
Species, or not
well,
Enterprise,
the Zindi.
Yeah.
The Zindi, yeah. But even they look pretty awful 20 years later.
Ooh, yeah. Tech was not there yet.
No. But yeah, so we got the Borg that we have today, of course. But the upgrade to the Borg from the TV show to the movie was huge.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Voyager got the advantage of just using that design moving forward.
Yeah.
But
well, they deserve that special effects makeup nomination. They should have won.
Yeah.
Like, I have no idea.
I don't know who they competed against or who they lost to that year.
Probably a period piece.
In 96, I don't really remember, but I can look that up.
Always period pieces. But the Borg Queen is just an astounding costume.
Mm-hmm.
The makeup work, it looks like her flesh I can't spot the bald cap. I can't spot
where,
like, those staples in her skin look real. Like, it's just intense. So, very well done.
And Alice, I don't know how you say her last name, Krieg, is fantastic in that role.
Mm-hmm. No, she's wonderful, and they wanted to get her back for Voyager, but there was a scheduling issue, so she came back for the finale, but she wasn't back for the other episode. They actually had a different actor play the Queen once.
That's too bad.
Yeah, she's great. There's some really cool behind the scenes stuff about that scene where she comes down from the ceiling and everything, and the way she's blue screens. Well. It did. Really, really well done.
There's actually a really cool, I just saw it within the last 2 days, a really cool behind the scenes photo of Jonathan Frakes like leaning playfully up against Alice Krieg.
Yes.
And you can see her like leaning into that like the spine piece of the suit, and like she's behind it, but it's such a cool effect, and like, you know, Jonathan Frakes is a director like geeking out all happy. Like it's such a really cool photo.
So this is going to be depressing for everybody involved.
Yeah, probably.
So only three movies were nominated for that the Makeup Award in 1997's Oscars.
Okay.
Which was, of course, Star Trek First Contact, Ghosts of Mississippi, and the winner, The Nutty Professor.
Oh. Why?
The Nutty Professor beat out the freaking Borg? Are you kidding me?
That hurts.
That does hurt.
That was such a bad movie.
It was.
Like, they had all the Borg they had to do makeup for, Data and Worf, and somehow, like, a fat Eddie Murphy wins?
Right. And, I mean, okay, makeup, whatever, like, you know, give Eddie Murphy credit for playing multiple characters. That's great, but
they
makeup
should win for Gates's blonde hair based on that, because that looked amazing.
It did. I prefer her as a redhead, but like I was still like, oh, you're doing something new. I'm on board. I have a huge unabashed crush on Gates McFadden.
I have a crush on Crusher.
I'm a big Gates McFadden fan too. I always had a crush on her too, especially as a redhead. But she looks really good as a blonde.
She does. Even at her current age, if she was like, hey. What's going on?
I think the uniform does help, because it's a really good-looking uniform on everybody. Like, I think they all just look better in this movie.
Troy looks better with straight hair than she does at perm.
Oh, she looks... Okay, so I actually think she looks great when she's down on Earth in the bar and she's drunk and she's trying to, like, get...
Time? Can't talk about time. We don't have time for that.
There's no time.
I know
time.
That's not the line.
Don't argue
so
with
sorry.
Me about time.
No, you're fine.
Don't have the time. But I she just looks really good in that scene. And
I truly believe that Jonathan Frakes was like literally falling in love with Marina Sirtis at that moment. Like, this is perfect. I love you. We're gonna really get married.
I feel like the two of them are like, even in real life, are very close. Like,
they always had good chemistry.
They did.
I think that's why their characters, that arc continued for all the whole show and the movies, because they had that chemistry anyway. But, okay, so down on the planet, you've got Troy, and she's completely wasted trying to get Cochran to admit who he is and everything like that.
If
after three
James
shots of something
Cromwell
called tequila...
could never dance again, I'd be very
like... I love James Cromwell, but you're right, dancing is not his forte.
No.
I don't want to see him doing the Ooby Dooby ever again. That was a bit much.
Take as many leaks in the woods as you need. Let's keep dancing out of this.
So I love the Cochran character, and I'm a huge James Cromwell fan, and I know he's played multiple roles on Star Trek, this obviously being his biggest and most important, but this might be my favorite role of his in general, because it's just...
More than the farmer on Babe, Derek? You trying to tell me
definitely more than the farmer on Babe.
That'll do, pig.
but this character is so important to the Star Trek mythos, and I like how they humanize him as this guy who really wasn't out to try and change the world.
Wanted to make money, wanted to get drunk and have sex with strippers.
But he rose to the occasion.
Yeah.
Right? When he realized what it meant, he met that.
And that is the embodiment of Trek. It's self-improvement. It is growth. It is optimism. And Cochran is a perfect symbol of that.
But honestly, like, I totally get where he's coming from. All those people showing the hero worship, Jordy mentioning the statue. I'd want to walk away from that, too.
Sure.
There's a lot of
be
pressure.
There's
a lot of pressure on your shoulders.
A lot of pressure just in general. But when you figure in the historical context at this point, this is like a fringe society that has survived this terrible World War III. Like, I can understand. Cool. Like, I want to live for the moment. I want to get drunk. I want to have a lot of sex. I want to make a lot of money. I want to retire somewhere on an island. I don't want to make the world a better place because I've lived through this traumatic war and I've seen what it's done to this planet. I don't believe that there can be better for this world. And so, I get it. I get his character. The context is important and I love what he becomes.
So I'm going to admit something that was a misunderstanding when I was a kid. So, because, I mean, when this movie came out, I was 9. Uh-huh. So I've been watching this movie since I was 9. And when I was a kid, I misunderstood that he wanted to sell the ship technology to be rich and then get an island full of naked women. I thought he wanted to take the ship as a means of transport. And I thought, when I saw it, I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would he go to outer space just to come back to an island? Didn't he know where it was going to take him?
And you can't fit that many naked women on that ship. It was right? Super small.
Right, like the 3-seater ship. This makes no sense.
You got to be multiple trips for all those naked women.
And then at some point, I watched it again in college and paid attention. I was like, oh.
Yeah. Now it's all coming together.
So there's a little bit about me.
That's very cute.
Yeah.
Well, your entire goal is to go to space and stay there. Like, that's not everybody's goal.
Well, I mean, I didn't think he would. His goal was to be stuck in space. But, you know, just if your goal is to go from Montana to an island, you certainly don't need a warp ship. So,
right.
It's not that far of a flight.
It's a very creative middleman.
Right. To need his ends. Okay, so yeah, but to your point, like, yeah, you know, he went to Zephyrin Cochran High School, and you know, Barkley's all giddy over him and everything, and
they could have toned that down a bit. It, you know, they didn't have to make him feel so awkward.
Well, especially since the temporal prime directive is a thing that they call out in the movie.
Yeah,
right.
They totally just disregard it.
Totally throw it out the window. Like, you can give Janeway a hard time about ignoring the prime direct, the temporal prime directive, yeah, which is true. But like, this whole crew does it.
Oh yeah,
right. So yeah, they totally should have toned that down a little bit. But then you don't, you know, get to have Riker shoot Cochran in the back. Right. Which is a fun moment, but mm-hmm. So of course all this stuff is happening. I like the Barkley cameo, but his little bit role, because I think Barkley is a highly underrated character.
Yeah, as we've talked about in a few previous episodes, for those of you keeping score at home,
we did a best did best guest appearance, and it was Barkley. Is that what
we did? That was the one that I chose.
Barkley was also chosen for our cast the first time we did the Ultimate Star Trek crew.
Yeah, Barkley is just, he's a really cool character, incredibly intelligent and smart. He was basically Tilly before Tilly.
Yes.
You know, he was a flawed person who had very real issues that people could relate to. Now, he's not the same character as Tilly, of course, but you know, he had a stuttering problem, he had social anxieties, you know, he had confidence issues, but incredibly intelligent.
Yes.
And hell, he's basically responsible for helping bring Voyager home.
Yeah,
you know, in a lot of ways, and so
I like Barkley and what he embodies, and I mean, hell, I hope we see more of him.
It would be cool. Yeah. I think you could have him in the Picard show pretty easily.
Oh yeah,
without any problems.
Yeah,
and that would be really great. But you know,
yeah. And as a side note, I don't want to see the Picard show be strict fan service where they're just carting out cameos every week.
No.
But I also don't want it to be exist in a bottle where they totally ignore that there are all these other characters that are important either.
Like, right.
There's got to be a balance that they can find.
I want to see some of this that we talk about, yes, not literally every bit of it.
If we saw all of it, I'll be disappointed. I don't need to get everything I want. That would be terrible.
These are just different things we would like.
Yes.
Individually.
Yes. For sure.
So, okay, so all that stuff's happening down the planet. Meanwhile, on the ship, the Borg are spreading and they're taking over.
It's pretty sad watching all those people get assimilated. Like, yeah. I think the first time I watched it, it wasn't so real to me, but, you know, I grow older and death means more to me. It affects me more. Things like plagues and pain mean more to me. So just watching all of that is, it was much more emotional this time around than it was the first time.
Yeah, I mean, the Borg are a plague, right? I mean, that's basically what they are.
They're zombies. They're space zombies.
Yeah. Right? It's the Star Trek zombie flick.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's a great point. So yeah, it is really intense. And you've got, so you have the sick bay scene where Robert Picardo gets his little role.
That's fun. I really enjoy that.
Speaking of like fan service that's not overly heavy, you get Robert Picardo, you get
Ethan Phillips.
Ethan Phillips, like, they do a few fun nods.
Well, all three, between Barkley, the EMH and sort of Neelix.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, you get Hollow these three Neelix. Little kind of cameos, which is super cool. Right? And, like, you don't even really notice it. It's just as part of the story.
Right. And it was very smartly done. Again, some further cementing that this is one of the best Trek films.
And the EMH gets a very Trek line, right? I'm a doctor, not a doorstop. Right? So it's a throwback to Bones.
Yeah.
You know? And it's very in character for the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Except he's wearing the new uniform, which I thought was a nice little touch.
Yeah.
Which, maybe that makes
it
sense.
It makes sense that their EMH would look like their crewmates.
Yeah.
I wanted to say employees. The holodeck program would have been, or not holodeck, but the program would have been updated for that ship, and that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a really cool moment. Yeah, you got the holodeck, so, okay. So I have a little bit of a problem with the holodeck scene, and it's not what happens necessarily, but, all right, so it's Dixon Hill.
Sure.
And it's Dixon Hill because it's a throwback to the show when he did Dixon Hill a few times and to kind of bring you more of Picard's character of who he is, right?
It's also to honestly get a very attractive woman, Alfre Woodard, in better looking clothes than hobo outfit.
Yeah, like, yeah.
To be completely honest.
Future hobo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get Patrick Stewart in a white suit, she's in a dress, you know.
And they look amazing.
They're a good looking couple.
They really do.
That's a fair point. But so it's a little convoluted for me because the whole point is he needs to get to the right chapter to get a Tommy gun so he can kill the Borg with bullets rather than energy weapons. So a couple of things I want to pull from this. One, why not just have the holodeck make you a weapon?
Yeah, because can't they just replicate?
It can do that. Well, even if you don't use the replicator for me, because I'm going to get to that. But in the holodeck, just say, holodeck, I need a Tommy gun.
Right.
And then it gives you a Tommy gun, right? But you don't need the narrative for it.
You don't. But it's a movie, and you got to have that dramatic aspect to it. So there's got to be a goal.
Now, it does let him have the really emotional moment of, like, the shouting and, like, about to, like, bash its head in, and she has to stop
PTSD
him.
PTSD flare-up, flashback, whatever you call it.
Which comes up later in the conference room.
I don't think the conference room makes sense if you omit a scene where he doesn't already step over the line. You know, like, you have to show multiple steps. Otherwise, it's just you out there saying that this guy's out of control.
And a lot of movies have this problem, Trek aside, but this movie definitely exhibits that, where there is a constant battle between plot and character. And so there are some movies that are better character films and other movies that are better plot films. And it always seems like there's this constant battle of, like, finding that balance. It's like, if I want to make an intellectually realistic film about this character and what they're going through, there's going to be some questionable plot choices. And if I want a plot that's believable, then some of these characters are going to occasionally behave in a way that doesn't quite make sense.
True.
And that's fair. And I think that Picard is in character in this movie. I know a lot of people knock him for becoming an action star all of a sudden, but I think because it's the Borg,
makes sense.
Exactly. This isn't the Klingons. This isn't the Romulans. This is the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes him unstable, which is what the Admiral was worried about. Mm-hmm. The Admiral's not wrong, right? Picard is an unstable element in this scenario, and he proves that later on. Now, he's a necessary element. No one else is going to defeat them.
No.
Because you need someone with that knowledge, that connection, to defeat the Borg. But he is unstable. And so my other issue that comes from this is the replicator system, right? So by now, this is not the first time, the second time the Borg have been encountered. After Wolf 359, and they destroy dozens of ships and thousands of lives.
Including Sisko's wife.
Including Sisko's wife. At what point do you have a protocol where you have non-energy weapons available to fight the Borg?
I think the last thing that Roddenberry wants is to see his Trek crew hold handguns.
Yeah.
And honestly, it does kind of, like, ruin the image of the Utopia if the whole crew does it. If one man goes rogue, that's fine. And maybe that one man should have replicated a gun or two, because obviously Alfre Woodard's character has no qualms about a regular gun either. So I don't know.
I think that it's a little disingenuous is too strong of a word, but it's silly, I think, to look at the phasers, especially the phaser rifles that are used in this movie, and somehow say, well, because it's an energy light pulse, it's somehow better than a bullet.
No, I agree.
Right? Especially when, like, she was going to literally vaporize Picard if she had shot him, right?
Yeah.
Like, and they show that happening in Star Trek, the vaporizing, and it is a painful-looking procedure.
Yeah.
Right? And so, for me, it just seems kind of silly for there to be any in-universe or even out-of-universe explanation for why, by the time First Contact is happening, there isn't a contingency plan for non-energy weapons against the Borg. Because what are they going to adapt to? Maybe you can't retrofit your ships, but from a hand-to-hand combat scenario, how hard would it be to replicate some guns?
Yeah, not hard at all.
You know, and I would think that, okay, maybe the average crew member can't do it, but you'd think Picard certainly has the authority to have the computer do that for at least that security detail he puts together with Data and Worf.
Yeah.
Correct.
You know, because even Worf's like, look, you'll get 12 shots at most. Mm-hmm. That's not a lot of shots.
No. And if you can spend half as many shots with actual bullets and get the job done, then...
Right? So I just, that's always kind of bothered me a bit. I get early on that it wouldn't have happened because we didn't really know them. And even at Wolf 359, we wouldn't have been ready for them.
But at this point.
But after Wolf 359, you'd think we would be somewhat prepared for something like this.
Sure. But there's also the added element of like, this is a sci-fi movie for fans that, you know, that tried to be for everyone. And so like to add bullets, you know, may not have been.
All right. Well, you can extend it and look at Voyager. Voyager never even switches to non-energy weapons against the Borg.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You know, so even they don't figure it out. They switch to the nanovirus stuff, but they're still using phasers.
I love Voyager, but I mean, that you can put that on the long list of problems.
Yeah, I mean, people who listen to the show know I love Voyager, too. But, I mean, you know, there's some consistency problems when it comes to, like, some logical leaps.
For sure.
All right, so anyway, so there's some intensity here. Like, you know, she points out, Lily points out that this is one of his crew members. He's got the insignia, you know, in his chest and, you know.
Ensign Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty big moment later in the conference room when, you know, she explains like he didn't even try to save him. And there's an interesting point to be made here because Picard was assimilated for an extended period of time and his crew brought him back.
Yeah.
What about all of these Borg?
Right.
Right? Like, you know, at what point do you justify trying to save somebody? He goes back to save Data.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, nobody else, right? Right. And some of that, I guess, is for
Seven
effect.
And Nine was... de-assimilated. Like, I don't know if that's a word. I'm having fun.
She was brought back as well, and you know.
So we know in canon it's totally possible, and not just on one occasion. You know, they mention how special Picard is, but Seven and Nine wasn't special. She was taken as a little kid, and.
But Picard, with his particular experience and his PTSD, it's very likely that he can look at these people and think, fuck, I know what I deal with. I don't want anyone else to have to be dealing with this as well. And so it makes an easier choice with him. Like, because he even makes the line, he's like, you know, if you get close, kill them, basically, because, you know.
They're not who you are.
You'll be doing them a favor.
Yeah, that's the line.
Yeah.
And he does. He puts one of his crew members out of their misery.
It doesn't mean that he's happy about it, but he knows the suffering that he lives with on a daily basis, and he feels justified in not inflicting that on anyone else.
When you guys first saw Neil McDonough, who plays Hawk, great name, by the way, you guys knew, like, he existed to die later on, right?
Very expendable.
Like, a slightly famous face, but not super famous enough to keep on board, so...
A TNG red shirt, if you will.
I wasn't 100% sure, simply because... The movies had done this with, like, Savick, for example, right? She's introduced in Star Trek 2. She returns in Star Trek 3 and a little
supposed
bit in 4.
To be in 6.
And she's supposed to be in 6, but because of the casting problems, they decided to go another way. So the idea of introducing a character in a movie and keeping them around wasn't new.
Correct.
To Trek.
Yeah.
So there was actually a part of me who is like, oh, they're just expanding the cast a little bit now that they're, like, really doing these movies. You know, this is happening.
Sure.
That's stereotypical horror film. The new face is usually the first to go.
But he wasn't. He went much later.
He did.
You know?
He is one of the few ones with a name that gets to go.
Yeah.
Like it's Porter Lynch and him.
he at least had a noble end. He got to be part of something before dying.
We know his last name, unlike Guy.
Yeah.
Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
There. Anyway. So, so the ship, they just keep losing the ship. They do the deflector dish scene. I have some opinions about the deflector dish scene. What about you guys?
I do have some opinions.
What are they? care to share?
I want magnetic boots. That's my only opinion.
It's fun. It's a very cinematic action film scene.
I think it's way too slow. It is very an action scene. They try to do the suspense thing.
They trailed though. It's a big tonal shift. Little pieces of the fun behind the scenes fact, little pieces of the deflector dish were actually bird feeders.
Oh man, that's hilarious. I totally see that now.
Stick in the ground bird feeders. I love Worf's line, the assimilate this. It's like a typical action movie, like nonsense.
Right.
It was a lot of fun. It was cool seeing those characters interact, and like there was a bit of dramatic tension and like, you know, the Borg's floating away. Like, it was a well done scene, not the highlight of the film by any means, but it's something that I like. The whole stepping out the first time on the underside, everything's flipped upside
down.
So
cool.
Like, that is cool.
That's a great shot. The ingenuity that it took for Picard to shoot the ship instead of the Borg. Watching them float away like that was pretty amazing. And I didn't understand why he didn't just finish it off.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I mean,
we got one that way.
They do talk about, like, if you hit the deflector, you basically destroy half the ship.
Right.
You know, if you shoot the ones that were actually over there, then you risk blowing up the ship.
He was very much against blowing up the ship. As we will later talk about.
No!
The line is here, this far, no farther.
I don't buy that Worf gets nauseous on a spacewalk. I don't buy it at all.
Worf is kind of weird, though.
Why do they consistently try to make him weak to make others look stronger? Like, that bothers me so much. I want to see him just kick some ass over and over again.
I agree, though. The show does emasculate Worf on a regular basis.
And it's not necessary. And it's just to make somebody else look better.
Right, because it's always like, if this Klingon is being emasculated, then Picard must be really strong for telling him off.
Right. Or, like, even just the spacewalk is like, well, if Worf gets nauseous but Picard doesn't,
right?
And Picard's, like, cracking jokes about it, like, you know.
Do Klingons have multiple stomachs?
They do.
Oh, well, then maybe that's why.
And this is
interesting.
You're welcome.
So is only one of his stomachs nauseous? How's that work?
This is what I love about Deep Space Nine. That was a side note: is that like they don't rely on that as much. Like, Worf gets to be very much his own powerful, you know, self-actualized person.
That's true. We do get to see the Mechleth, which is the smaller blade weapon, which is super cool.
Very much so.
I do love the touch of him tying the Borg's arm to his suit to stop the air from leaking out.
Yeah.
It's a very Worf thing to do.
Yes.
So that's pretty spot on to me. The problem I have with this, and this may just be like a technical spec issue that I'm not aware of, so if anybody out there understands the specs of the Enterprise E better, they're detaching the main part of the deflector dish, right?
Yeah.
So doesn't that mean they can't really go anywhere because it's what deflects all the space debris from flying through the ship?
I mean, that seems like a good point.
Okay.
I don't know.
Like, I thought that's what that is.
I honestly, I don't know exactly what the deflector dish is for.
That's what it's for. Like, the deflector dish is in canon. It's designed to deflect objects and small objects in front of the ship. So rocks, space dust, meteorites, that type of thing.
I imagine sans deflector dish, they'd have to rely more heavily on front-facing shields. I don't know.
Yeah, I get maybe. But somehow...
Does it really work? I guess.
Right. So
I guess for warp, it'd be a bigger concern.
So I guess they go through they just can move at impulse, maybe then they just go back through the time vortex and they're back at Earth and they just get a new deflector dish because they're already at Earth. Speaking of which, it's a missed opportunity to not show Earth's space dock.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Or the Golden Gate Bridge.
The Golden Gate Bridge.
Gotta have the requisite Golden Gate Bridge shot. Almost getting hit, but not quite.
Not quite. Okay, so that's a cool scene. We move on from that. We've got the launch of the Phoenix, which is a great name for the ship.
It's a great launch. It's a great name for... just Trek history at that point in time and what it symbolizes. So,
well, I think it also symbolized a lot for what the ship was, because it was built on a nuke, right? And this is after World War III. So it's being reborn as this ship of peace for the future.
Yeah, reborn from the ashes of our conflict into peace for our future, which is
beautiful.
Yeah,
I really love that. The Phoenix is my favorite mythological creature, so a little bit. Bias there.
Unicorns, bitches.
All right. No judgment.
I'll take the flying firebird that can be reborn. anyway, so yeah, so the ship launches. I love the music moment where he can't find.
Wait, we can't take off.
Can't take off without it. So for anybody here who thought the whole Beastie Boys thing and beyond was not canon.
Yeah, we got Steppenwolf here in 96.
There's been pop music in Trek, not yes. often, but it's there.
And honestly, like, I mean, we'll get to this maybe when we discuss those movies, but like, I do love the Beastie Boys. Like, that, I love that song that's used in those movies. No. Yeah. Especially in Beyond.
I will say that the fact that we've moved to streaming music is really sad because I'm never going to get music on those cool little crystal discs.
Yeah.
And I would always thought that was going to happen someday.
Well, so. Yeah, look, Derek, we are on the cusp of World War III anyways. So who knows what technology is going to do as we have to survive this nightmare.
Oh, God.
But it's okay. 2063. It's coming.
It's coming. Yeah.
Some of us might be alive for it.
So what do you think of the Phoenix itself? How do you? Like, I know Ray, you're not a big ship person, so I apologize.
That's
but
fine. Go ahead.
What do you get? What do you think of the ship of the actual Phoenix?
I mean, I like it. It looks very reminiscent of early spacecraft and NASA's lineage. As a side note, I'm a big Enterprise fan, and I love that the opening sequence uses that.
Yes.
I think I'm in a small minority, but I do like the opening sequence. I like the Faith of the Heart song. Like, I love that shot where the ship, like, they actually get the footage from First Contact and it bursts open. And it's like, it's beautiful and optimistic and hopeful. And I like the rickety kind of worn-in aspect of it because so much of Trek, you see these polished ships of the future after we've been developing space flight for, space travel for so long. It's nice to see that the heritage not only comes from the ruins of our conflicted past, but it's not exactly stable. It's a little shaky, and that's cool. You don't see much of that in Trek.
Mm-hmm. No, I do like that. I like the little nacelles because they're mm-hmm. very reminiscent of what the original Enterprise nacelles would end up looking like.
Yeah, very very cute nacelles.
And I actually really do like the intro to Enterprise, especially mm-hmm. that evolution of the ship. And I think that it's a nice transition.
It's you and me versus the world.
I guess so, right? It's a nice transition though from the Phoenix to the NX-01. I think they bridge that gap really well. So I like that. So, okay, so then, of course, you've got the intense parts on the ship. So Picard doesn't want to blow up the ship, and he tells off Worf.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty crazy moment. And if this
incredibly undeserved. It's one of the more disappointing things that Picard has ever done.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But not to jump ahead and, like, squelch that moment, but more importantly than him kind of being shitty to Worf in that moment, I love that the movie, because they could have cut it. It wasn't necessarily important to the film, but I love that there was that moment where Picard comes back and apologizes and says, in fact, you're one of the bravest men that I've ever known. And, like we all have, like, these outbursts and these moments of struggle, and the fact that Worf, or not Worf, but the fact that Picard showed up afterwards and, like, made a point of, like, yeah, I messed up and I need to make right by this. Like, that's something that I don't think we see enough cinematic or television heroes actually doing, is admitting fault and then growing.
Yeah, I mean, Picard is a flawed character, and his flaws are shown in the show, and his relationship with Worf is shown in the show.
Yeah.
There are things Picard gets to do on Kronos with Worf that humans don't get to do.
Yeah, they do have a very unique relationship for a human and a Klingon.
And so if you know the show and you know those characters, these moments are even more intense than they already are. Mm-hmm. If this was your entry point into Trek. And, they play around with the dialogue really well, because... I regret some of the things that I said earlier. It's like, some,
I love their dynamic.
And yeah, because there's that respect on both sides.
Yes.
Right. And, I appreciate that even though Picard basically gave Worf the biggest insult somebody could give him at this point in his life.
Yeah.
He still respects Picard enough to just walk away. Right. And not just knock his head off. I
know. And if this is your introduction to Trek, you don't realize how big of a deal it is that Worf's just like, fine.
If you were any other man, I would kill you where you stand. And it's just such a well-delivered line, and it's intense.
And it's not an empty threat either. It's,
no.
It is true.
No, and they changed Worf's look a little bit in this movie, because his look changes also when he moves over to Deep Space Nine a little bit. And so he just looks a little bit... like more intense, the makeup work is more sophisticated and mm-hmm. looks more real. Mm-hmm. And so that adds into it as well. So then he goes and has his talk with Lily.
Yeah.
And Ahab and hunting his whale.
You broke your little ships.
Ray, what are your opinions of that conference room scene?
I don't know.
Because you have a strong literature background.
I do. And I love comparisons to Moby Dick, especially because I feel like... I don't know, maybe it's my perspective, but I feel like men in particular have a Moby Dick complex at some point or another. So if you guys haven't had it yet, maybe, you know, your lives aren't over. Maybe when you're 60 and on a spaceship. But I love that she calls him out on it too. I love that she doesn't just take this anger and let it go, because that's not what Trek is. We don't, like, any other sci-fi would let this man have a temper tantrum and go about his plan and kill much more people, but she sticks with it and they work through the conflict and she brings him down. And that's what I truly liked about the scene, because that is what Star Trek's all about, is working through conflict and, you know, resolving things, not escalating. So the fact that he wouldn't back down and wouldn't back down until, you know, she got right in his face, it was like, fine, well, you know, we're going to go escape. You do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah. Well, and how many movies, I mean, outside of Trek at this point in time, would have a woman side character call out the male protagonist and have the male protagonist actually respond well to it? Like, which, in my opinion, like, speaks highly of Trek.
Well, I mean,
and equality.
Crusher is in no place to do it. She questioned it once, and she's used to things working out for Picard, so she just trusts that this will too.
Yeah.
Even though she kind of knows that it's going to be at the expense of much more people's lives. So it needed to be this outsider who doesn't trust Picard very much and doesn't trust anybody else. She just wants to live.
See, and that's actually the only part that bothered me, was that I actually think that TV show Crusher would have said something. But because Lily's there, her character's not allowed to say something.
That's fair. Movie Crusher is disappointing.
Yeah.
She's not as good as TV show Crusher.
It's frustrating because Lily takes the role that Crusher would have taken otherwise. Uh-huh. And because of that, her character has less to do, you know? And Crusher is never one to just take Picard's orders, ever.
Right.
True.
She if she does not completely agree with what he has to say, she questions, because she's the only one at a rank who can.
Yeah.
You know? She can order him to do stuff if the situation calls for it.
And not only just rank, they have the personal history to where that's appropriate.
Yes. And she doesn't get to do that here because Lily has to do it. And... Alfred Woodard does an amazing job. It's no knock on her. It's just because Lily's there, Crusher has to do less.
Yes.
And that bothers me a little bit.
No, that's fair. That's fair. I do also think, though, that there are some points in our lives where the people closest to us aren't able to adequately speak to the trauma that we're feeling. And it may take an outside person to be like, oh, okay, now I see it.
I love the scene in the conference room. I love when he just becomes furious and he crashes the wall, you know, she's got the line about how you broke your little ships.
Autobiographical.
It's a little autobiographical. But that's why I connect so much with the Picard character, right? I want to grow up and be Picard, but I'd want to serve under Janeway. I say it all the time on the show. Because I feel more like Picard, but I trust Janeway with my life, right?
Yeah.
So, the scene is just really telling, because I feel like I would have reacted emotionally anyway in a very similar way to the way Picard does.
Yeah.
I would be furious. I would be angry. I would want revenge, but try and come up with some logical way to explain why it's not actually revenge and it's really fine that I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. And the Ahab reference is perfect for Picard, because Picard is a red man. He's a sophisticated man. He even has this whole quote memorized from the book and everything, and she hasn't even read it, right?
I love that. There is nothing better for me than a literature fan who has not read a book, because that is pretty much all English majors during college were assigned, like 30 books a month, and so we cliff notes all of them. Mm-hmm. We've never actually read a full book.
You know each of these books intimately without having actually finished a single one. Yeah,
well, I like the idea of somebody who clearly already, like, this is such an iconic story. You know the basics, mm-hmm. right? So you can use it as a frame of reference, and I appreciate that she still comes out and says, actually, never. I never read.
And that's when someone has a self-awareness to admit that they haven't, like, read or, like, consumed a piece of media, like, that takes a level of humility.
There is a shame to it. Like, there if you is. Haven't seen or read or mm-hmm. watched or, you know,
absolutely.
People shame you for not being hip on the times. So
yeah, I still haven't seen Game of Thrones, and I get a lot of shade because of it.
The Godfather.
What?
I've never seen The Godfather.
I keep forgetting
movies.
This. Every time yeah. we have this conversation, it shocks me to my core.
Yep.
Most of sci-fi, Aliens... Yeah. Terminator.
We're going to fix that,
like,
though.
Most of the things.
Before the wedding?
Before the
wedding.
Monday. Anyway.
Sci-fi day at home on the calendar, and he thinks it's going to be Aliens and Terminator. It's really just going to be a Mad Max marathon.
Ain't nothing wrong with that.
Do we have to watch the Mel Gibson ones?
Yeah.
Anyway,
he's
so.
A Semite.
So, but this scene's really important because, you know, she says, actually, I never read it. And so he explains a little bit more about it. And it gives her then the chance to say, well, I guess he didn't know when to quit.
Yeah.
Right? Because she's trying to appeal to his intellect. And that's who he is mm-hmm. at the end of the day. He's the diplomat.
Yes.
He is the Federation's diplomat. That's why Sisko and Janeway are so different. The dichotomies are really strong. They're very different personalities. And so that's how you get him to agree.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it works really well. It's a really cool moment with a character we hadn't seen before, and I think it's really hard to do that with an ensemble cast.
Yeah,
you know, because you expect it to be Crusher, you expect it to be Riker or
well,
Worf
or
something.
You want it to be those characters, and
right,
like you said, there is kind of a sadness that you get when it's not one of those. When it is this outsider who's never coming back to the series.
But it almost, you know, thinking it through, it almost shows just how unhinged Picard is when Worf, of all people, is like, we should stop and destroy the Borg any way we can.
Right.
When he's done fighting
mm-hmm.
and you're still ready to rumble,
yeah,
you need to kind of check yourself at that
yeah.
point,
probably.
Right? Because he loves a good fight. But
yeah.
He's also not an idiot.
Right.
You know? Right. So of course, they decide to blow up the ship, and then you get the big climax scene in the engineering room with the Queen and Data and Picard.
It's one of the best scenes.
So how do you guys feel about the whole Data with real skin thing?
Oh, it's so creepy.
In a good way or a bad
no.
way?
No.
Not in a good way? You didn't like it?
I get what she was going for, but it was creepy.
Yeah, they're trying to make him like Frankenstein's monster. It's definitely very elusive to that. So it just bothered me the whole time because Data is far from a undeserving, unintelligent life form that you're trying to elevate. Like, he's not a simpleton that you just piece together. Sorry, bitch. Like,
right.
That's not how this goes.
Well, but more than just the Frankenstein's monster aspect, I feel like we would be remiss not to note the incredible sexual tension between.
God, it's so weird.
It's so weird.
Why?
It did not feel natural at all. But I mean, hey, they're both machines, so I mean,
fully functional in multiple techniques.
Yeah, I mean, when we're assuming what this is the first person he would have been intimate with since Tasha.
Well, they actually date it correctly when he says how, like, she asks him
yeah,
how long it's been
long
or whatever.
Been, yeah,
and it dates back
yeah.
to that episode. So
yeah,
like, that's kind of a cool moment.
Mm-hmm.
That they reference that. So for, like, the Trek fans out there who watch TNG can have that, oh, moment. And everybody
yeah.
else is like, okay.
Yeah. 7 years ago, whatever.
Let me just say that under the society's current climate, it's a little rapey. Like, she is still his keeper. He is still the hostage, the prisoner. Even if he does kind of consent,
mm-hmm.
it's not cool.
It's consent under duress.
Yeah. It's coercion
mm-hmm.
or, you know, it's just not very pleasant to watch. So it was something I just had to kind of squirm at and look away. And there's
yeah.
so many of those where if it was gender swapped in movies, if it was the dude coming on to the woman in this particular case, it would be much creepier. But for some reason we give women passes. for this. It's like when the teacher is a female and hooks up with her male students, other guys are like, yes, that's awesome. No, it's not.
It's still statutory.
Mm-hmm. So it's just a little weird for me.
That's fair. I mean, they get a little bit of a bump, too, because neither of them are really human, and so you can disconnect a little bit more.
Yeah. And I'm just saying, like, it's not the worst offender this year that made me swear, but it's not.
And that's the problem, like, just as a side note, that's the problem with consuming media from a couple decades ago now, is that there are a lot of things that have shifted, even in the last couple of years, that we just weren't engaging with in a way previously. And so to see it come up, you're like, oh man, yeah, that would not fly in a movie today at all.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So, you know, there's not a whole lot that goes on in that scene. Picard tries to convince her to let Data go. Mm-hmm. Not really sure what the whole point is, because she knows that the self-destruct is on. So mm-hmm. even if he decides to join her, they're all going to blow up anyway. So... Uh-huh. I'm not sure what anybody's goal is at that point. Like,
that's fair.
The coolest part, clearly, is when Data emerges from the fog and the skin is gone and his android's parts are revealed. Like, that was really fun special effects.
It was. It's the first time you get to see what his eyes look like. Mm-hmm. And so they did a really good job with that. And yeah, it's the most of him really exposed that we've ever seen. We get to see part of his arm and most of his face, and it's really cool looking.
I love that line about, like, you know, how he thought for a time.
0.63 seconds.
For an android, that's eternity.
That's an eternity. But it's an interesting point, though, right? Because it means, like, think of how many, you know, you hear throughout the show, like, how many calculations he can make in a second, right? Trillions of calculations.
Yeah.
So he thought it through a few trillion times is what that means, right? And so, you know, it's...
Like Doctor Strange.
Right, exactly. It's exactly like that. So, you know, Picard's like, oh, okay, that's nothing. But really, he did process that information a great deal, and it was very appealing to him in the moment, which I think is kind of interesting. The special effects of her dying looks pretty freaking cool still.
Yeah.
I still think they did an amazing job, right? Like, just really solid. The special effects are just mostly really good in this movie. Some of the gas effects are not great. They don't hold up perfectly, but overall, you know, pretty solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on kind of that big climax battle?
No.
You have Indiana Jones Picard swinging. Yeah. From
It was fun.
Fun is the best way to describe it.
I'm fine with it. It's fine.
Just let it go at this point. Come on.
So then we come back to the planet, Earth, as it were, and the Vulcans show up, and we get to see a cool old Vulcan ship, and they try and do the Vulcan salute, and I just want to put it on record
that Zefram Cochrane can't do it either.
So you're justified in being able to do it.
All right, if Cochrane's good enough for a handshake, so am I, damn it. So it's a fun scene. Right? Yeah. You get to see, it's interesting, the Vulcans drink some alcohol.
They do.
Which is something they don't really do.
And they're startled by the music. And you know, like, when he sits back down after, like, Cochrane's like, no, it's okay. Like, he sits back down at the end, and you're like, you know they're thinking, like, what the fuck? And it's like, in that moment, he's probably thinking, like, yep, we're gonna have to suppress these people for generations. And then you watch Enterprise, and you're like,
Cut to
Enterprise, and we're suppressing these people for generations because they suck.
Absolutely. It's a fun moment. I appreciate that the crew, like, stays around to kind of watch this moment in history happen.
Yeah,
you know,
it's such an important moment in Trek history.
And Why not? They go back home.
The really cute line that Lily and Picard envy each other for what they're about to do is fun.
Yeah,
the whole grass is greener is nice when you reflect on it, but you don't go for it.
Yeah, they both respect where each other is going, but they also both have their own plans. Yeah,
that tender moment, he gives you a little kiss on the cheek. It's a very sweet moment between the two of them.
Because they did really grow together and learn from each other. So
they were important to each other's growth.
A slightly more affection was kind of needed at that point, I thought. Yeah,
They shared something. Yeah. Two people out of time sharing an important moment.
That's good. It's really touching. But that's basically the movie.
Yeah.
It does have, I think, my favorite overall film score of all the Star Trek movies.
Yeah. Oh my God. It was such a good score.
It's really, really good. I love listening to it. It's not quite as iconic as, you know, the actual theme, but the whole score is really good.
Whole score and the incorporation of, you know, more modern music. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
It was. It was. Fun little notes. There is a sequel to this movie. In Enterprise season 2, there's an episode called Regeneration that actually is a sequel to First Contact, because they find some Borg frozen in the Arctic who like crashed to Earth after the sphere exploded. So that's a really cool little bit. It also has some people who believe that Enterprise is in a separate timeline called the First Contact timeline that takes place in that split.
That's interesting.
I don't think that that works because because Picard's people go back to their time.
Fan theories are
so
fun.
I agree.
You know, there's not too much more to them.
Well, because there are several timelines in Star Trek canon, it's important, I think, to analyze and try and figure out how many actually currently exist. And I don't think this First Contact one does, because then what future were Picard and his crew going back to? Are they then stuck in the First Contact timeline?
They have to note there were some differences.
Right?
Unless it was like such a subtly... Unless it's like you've got the main timeline and the other one just like an itty-bitty like offshoot. And it's like, okay, like...
So is that episode the only difference then? Yeah, maybe. Because then at that point, like, is there... Are there really two different timelines?
I don't know.
Right?
Maybe Picard goes back and his nephew's still alive. And he's like, oh, okay.
That's intense.
Yeah.
Too soon, man.
Yeah, too soon.
Any other notes or thoughts on Star Trek First Contact before we wrap up?
Nope. It's really enjoyable.
Yeah, it was just a lot of fun. You know, current events, you know, both public and personal are not exactly shiningly optimistic. And so I appreciated the opportunity to get to rewatch this film. It's one of my feel-good movies that I turn to every so often. And so, yeah, just a good, fun, wholesome time.
I think this one really marks the pinnacle of the golden age of Star Trek.
Yeah.
1996, TNG is at full throttle in film. Deep Space Nine, Voyager, you know, this is like huge. Conventions are everywhere. You've got the Vegas experience, you know, and this movie, I think, really marked that pinnacle point. I think after the film, things started to go back to the decline. For the golden age of Star Trek. So this was it. This was the top, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
So next week, Greg is going to still be on his away mission. So we are going to move on to Star Trek Insurrection.
Woo!
So if you haven't seen that one in a while, rewatch that one, because we will be discussing that one in all of its glory next week. So Zach, if people want to find you out on the interwebs, where can they do that?
At AvengersES on either Twitter or Instagram. I think it's the same handle. So, yeah, either place.
Ray?
I am Siren Ray, and I'm a cosplayer, so if you follow me on anything, it'll be mostly costumes. Second thing is weird questions that will make you feel awkward and trash talk. So, you know, join me for that.
Fantastic. I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter and Facebook, so you can join me out there to talk Trek and video games and other nerdy things. You can also find Ray and I on Screen Heroes, the Woo! Heroes Podcast Network's movie and TV podcast series. We talked a lot of film and TV things, reviews, rankings, top lists, that type of stuff.
Yep.
So you can follow us on Twitter at RedShirtsPod if you want to follow Redshirts and Runabout specifically. Otherwise, we will catch you guys next week.
Bye.
Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. The show is hosted by myself, Gregory Bosco, along with Jeremy Munkin and Derek Mayer. The theme song is by Flying Killer Robots. You can find us, as well as other Heroes Podcast Network shows, at heroespodcast.com, as well as on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, and anywhere you can use an RSS feed. Follow us on social media at Heroes Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitch. And you can also email us at contact@heroespodcast.com. Engage.